I'm David Clark on behalf of Mr. Graham. And I guess following the last case, I'm also here to overturn a harsh result that was entered against a lawyer.
But your client had quite a bit more due process.
He certainly did. That's correct.
I mean, he had a chance to put on evidence and had a judge rule on it and basically ruled against him on the facts.
That's true, and I'm well aware of the issues on factual review.
It's like mounting,
clear
like mounting Kilimanjaro.
Clear air. On the other hand, the application and the interpretation of the tax code is reviewed de novo.
But what you basically have here, if I let me just cut to the chase, what you basically have here is a determination of intent to defraud the commissioner, the United States, and the question is, did he do all these very suspicious things, which he did, simply to hide assets from creditors, or did he do them also to conceal assets from the tax authorities? And you had a judge look at it, and by and large, it seems to me a highly factual determination. What is there here? What law is there to apply here?
Well, with respect to the 1995 year, let me address that.
Okay.
There was substantial evidence on the record of a plausible non-tax motive for assigning the income to his children. And recall also that not only did he assign the income, but he assigned the actual asset. And
because it's plausible doesn't mean the other conclusion is clearly erroneous, does it?
Well, we cited cases to you that juxtapose a plausible non-tax motive like asset protection versus a clear and convincing determination of a specific intent to evade a tax known to be due.
He didn't actually pay the taxes, did he?
He did not pay the 1995 tax that was attributable.
So it's entirely possible. Let's say, look, I'm desperate to hide my assets from my creditors, so I'm going to put it in the name of the children. But God forbid, I don't want to cheat Uncle Sam, so I'm going to pay the tax on it.
Well,
it's possible to do that. You're a tax lawyer. You know it's possible to do that, yes?
It would have been very inconsistent to pay tax on both an income and an asset that had been assigned to somebody else.
Okay, but inconsistency is not a fault. You can do it. You can do it anonymously. You can get your lawyer to send the money in and say, I'm doing it on behalf of an unnamed client who is paying, believes he owes this amount of tax. And if it comes up, the lawyer discloses the name and says, yes, this is the very client who sent in the tax money, right? He doesn't have to disclose his identity. He doesn't, right? Am I dreaming here?
Hypothetically, you're correct. But for a taxpayer to...
I'm sorry, what you're saying hypothetically, I don't know what you mean. This is a hypothetical.
He could have done that. Yes.
Okay, if he wanted to pay the tax, if he wanted to say, look, I'm going to cheat my creditors, I'm going to try to conceal assets and avoid, you know, my just debts to everybody in the world except the government, he could have done that.
Yes, but that would have been inconsistent with the motive to and the implementation of an asset protection plan.
Why is that?
Well, and recall also...
Why is that?
Because
why couldn't he conceal assets by putting in the name of his children and send a check to the government to cover the taxes? Recognize that this is a sham to cheat creditors, but we're not going to cheat Uncle Sam. We're going to pay our taxes. Perfectly plausible thing to do. Your client's a lawyer. He knows about stuff like that.
Well, I agree. It's hypothetically possible, but it would have been inconsistent conduct on his part, and it would have been inconsistent with an asset protection motive.
Well, okay, now, Ms. Clark, what about the other, I'll call it, inconsistent conduct that the tax court judge found? In other words, that, you know, this was really a sham. It was only in name only, and he kept complete control of the asset, right? He made all the decisions. Are those factors or not factors which support the tax court's determination?
No, because I think that those do not bear on the clear and convincing requirement to prove a specific intent to evade tax. Him keeping control of the asset is more consistent with an asset protection motive. And recall the other evidence, you know, he encumbered a lot of other assets also to hide from creditors that had nothing to do with income taxes or income tax liabilities. Can I address the 1998 year? Are we finished with 95?
Is that the embezzlement year?
Yeah, and you want me to do that first? Let me talk about the constructive receipt on the embezzlement issue then, because here we do have uncontradicted evidence that the embezzler diverted the funds before they were received by the law firm.
Well, no, wait a minute. What do you mean by diverted? They were deposited into his own checking account.
I'm gonna right? get to that.
Well, how is that a diversion, though?
One step at a time. What was uncontradicted was that the client would send a check into the law firm. The office manager would steal that check without the knowledge of Mr. Graham.
It's not stealing to put it into the account in the name of the employer.
Well, no, she.
Why is that stealing?
Because she didn't put it into the business account. She put it into one of Mr. Graham's personal accounts.
Right.
Just temporarily.
I don't understand why that's stealing. How does that meet the theft statute? Well, it's not taking control away from the owner. I mean, you know, Graham still has full control of that money. In fact, she put other checks in there at his direction, right?
Correct. But I respectfully disagree with your conclusion that he maintained control of those funds just because of the happenstance.
All he had to do, you know, is look at his monthly balance sheet. Well, you know, I have $350,000 that I can spend at the end of the month, whatever it is, right? He had control of it.
Well, there was no
could have
no
gone
evidence.
Down to the bank and said, I want a cashier's check for my balance in that checkbook, right?
If he had an internet account, you know, he could check his balances daily.
I'm not sure they had internet accounts back in 1998, but he didn't have control because he didn't know that the funds had been diverted temporarily into that account, and then the embezzler stole those, or completed or consummated the embezzlement by stealing the money out of that account again without his knowledge. You know, we're all lawyers. We've all had accounts. But if you do not in fact know that funds have been diverted into your account, then it seems to me you cannot have control or access of them. And certainly there was no evidence here that there was any economic benefit at all realized by Mr. Graham. Therefore, that's why we have urged you to find that there can be no constructive receipt of income that he was not aware that had been temporarily placed in his account.
So the reverse pickpocket, the reverse pickpocket sticks wad of $100 bills into your pocket, you're not aware of it, then it's not income. That's your position.
It is. And that's why those cases that the government cited in
because
their briefs
are
distinguishable, because in those cases, consistent with your hypothetical, the business or the taxpayer actually had used the funds and then they were subsequently invested.
Why isn't this once again a factual question with the tax court, the judge looked at the evidence and asked the question, did he have control of the money, and found he did. Now, your client says he wasn't aware of it, but we don't have to believe him. You know, he has done plenty of lying in his day. We know that. He admits to trying to defraud creditors. So I can see why a trier of fact might not believe everything he says. Why doesn't this tax court judge require to believe your client when he says, I didn't know the money was there?
Well, because the government stipulated that these things had been done without his knowledge. If you look in the record, and we cited to this.
No, but it's a very different question. Whether he knew these things were done with his knowledge or whether he knew what was in the account. He got bank statements. He could go down to the bank and check.
Well, I don't believe there was any evidence in the record that, in fact, he did get bank statements. And the testimony from both the embezzler and from Mr. Graham was that she did not tell him and he did not know.
So it's a blind eye defense, basically. I can't see in the back of my pocket. I don't know how I was in the back of my head. I can't see what the big pocket put in my back.
To a certain extent, you're right. I mean, and the embezzler was, let's face it, the office manager and the bookkeeper and was essentially in control of the finances.
You say that the cases the government depends on are inapposite, but on the other hand, the main case that you depend on, you know, the diversion was not to another account, right, of the taxpayer, but to the embezzler's own account. And that's a completely different case. There's no case that supports your position on all fours, is there?
That is true, that there was a temporary diversion into my client's account from the moment the funds were initially stolen and to the ultimate enjoyment of those funds by the embezzler.
Okay, you've used up your time. Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. Richard Parker for the Internal Revenue Service. I'd like to address...
Tax Division?
Yes, sir. Tax Division Appellate Section.
Very good.
Thank you. First of all, with respect to having a plausible reason for defrauding other people, that's actually a badge of fraud and actually supports the trial court's findings. If you look at Solomon, which we cite on pages 37, as well as Kotka versus Commissioner on 3331, they both indicate that if a taxpayer is defrauding other people, including municipal tax agency or other corporations, that's an indication that they also are more likely to be defrauding the government. So as far as there being a plausible argument that just supports the government's position as well as the tax court's findings, that this was a badge of fraud. With respect to the embezzlement, I think it's important to note that taxpayer has conceded that he earned this income. It was rental income and income from clients. It was income that he actually received, and it was income that he went into his checking account, so he had actual
control. Well, but there's no, Mr. Clark's argument that, well, but it was diverted to this other account without the taxpayer knowledge. If he didn't know it was there, he couldn't spend it. You don't have a case right on point either, do you?
I don't believe we have a case right on point. However, it would be conceded that under 61A, it would be income to him since it's rental income and client fees that are due.
Because it went into
because he received it for his services.
It went into his personal account over which he had control?
No, because he performed the services. He was entitled to that income, so it was income to him.
I know, but he has to receive it.
He did receive it. It was paid to the firm. His office manager received it, and then he had actual receipt by it being put into his personal account.
Well,
so it's not even constructive because he had actual receipts.
Let me just test this, follow up on what Justice Sheen was asking. At what point would the government concede that he had not received it? He clearly earned it, right?
Right.
Okay, so let's say, let's just deal with cash just to make things simple. And let's say the client comes in and says, I owe Mr. Graham $1,000, and hands $1,000 to the office manager, who promptly takes $1,000, puts it in a pocketbook, and spends it for own purposes. At that point, let's say those were the facts. Would you say that was income to Mr. Graham?
That sounds more of the case that might have been in Alsop. But again, in the case in Alsop, the writer never knew about the income. It came in, it was directly taken without her knowledge or ever going in any commingling or anything like that. So I think our position would be that perhaps that was more like...
So that would be a case where very likely there would be a diversion before the income had...
Exactly.
Okay, let me extend it a little further. So let's say it's the same situation, but instead of putting it in her pocketbook, let's say that she deposits it in her account, in her checking account, her personal checking account. Same thing, right? Client is the taxpayer is not aware of it. The bookkeeper has diverted it, and it would be same situation, right? At what point does it become, because client had no control over the money. The taxpayer had no control over the money. At what point does the taxpayer get enough control over it to say that he has actually received the income?
I think we don't need to go that far because in this case, the funds were commingled. He had access to that checking account and he could use them.
Even if he was not aware that the funds were there?
Yes, I mean, if he wasn't aware because of all those shenanigans, he was going with all those different accounts and didn't know what money was there. As an actual matter, the fact is you can go to your bank, you get monthly statements, and you can have access to that money. It's in your account. And all he has to do is go to the bank and find out if it's there or not. Secondly, this is commingled funds. It was in there with all of his other money. So you can't.
So what's the what's the defined legal issue? I mean, is it actual receipt? Is that what has to happen?
The court framed it as constructive receipt.
Receipt?
They argue constructive. In this case, it was actual receipt.
But you're saying constructive receipt is sufficient. But in this case, it's actual receipt.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the reason it's actual is because he had legal control over that checking account.
Yes, Your Honor.
What happens if the check is handed over to the client or to the taxpayer, and the taxpayer then hands it to the accountant, who then steals it?
Well, you can hardly say that he didn't know that he had the funds available.
So. Is because when he is aware that the funds have.
I mean, if the check's in his hands at that point, that's actual receipt, isn't it?
And you think that would be dispositive?
I believe so. I mean, he would have the funds in his
hands. What
happened
in this case? He claims that he was not. The checks came in, and he never saw the checks.
Well, I believe that's what they're claiming. Yes.
The checks just came into the office.
The clients got billed. They sent in their funds as well as rental income. They came into the office manager who put them into his personal checking account, in which it was income to him. It was put into his personal checking account and commingled with his funds. It's very similar to the case of Donahue, which we do cite.
So the bottom line is that the taxpayer, not the government, is left holding the bag for bad employees or people that divert the funds?
Not at all. In this case, I mean, first of all, it's the taxpayer, if we go back to the pickpocket situation, that's earned income and probably after-tax dollars. So the taxes were paid. They weren't avoided. Furthermore, in this case, it wouldn't leave the employer in the bag. He'd be entitled to a 165 deduction if he was being able to prove theft in future years. In this case, there was a problem because of everything that was going on and the fact that they had a possibility of recovery from the embezzler, which was her retirement account as well as three homes that went into foreclosure. They had access to those funds and couldn't prove up the loss at that point. So no, they're not left hanging the bag.
But I mean, it's basically, though, the absolute liability for the income is the taxpayer, subject to offsets, deductions, or other things that you might be able to prove down the road, correct?
Correct. If a taxpayer earns income and it goes into their account, they should be paying taxes.
That's the end of the story.
Yeah.
Does that apply to us, too? I mean,
I would imagine paying income on taxes. Imagine paying taxes on your earned income.
And how? Now that we're complaining. Okay.
There are no further questions. I'll rest on the brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Would you like a minute for rebuttal? You don't have to take it.
1 minute, right?
1 minute.
We didn't talk about the 1998 amended return issue. You'll recall that Mr. Graham filed his 1998 return on October 15th, 1999, and that return omitted some $135,000 in fee income. The evidence was that he discovered that omission, called his accountant and tax return preparer, told him to report it. An amended return was prepared, filed, and the appropriate additional tax and interest was paid within either 3 or 4 weeks, depending upon how you see things. And he got hit with a fraud penalty on that too. And my argument on that is very simple, and it is this: when a taxpayer reveals an omission and cures it within 3 or 4 weeks, that is the opposite of a specific intent to evade a tax known to be due. And when a taxpayer does that voluntarily without being prompted by a governmental investigation or a governmental inquiry, I don't see how such a taxpayer
It's a plausible argument to make the entire fact, but the entire fact he didn't buy it. It's sounds to me like a highly compelling argument for the entire fact, but it's not one that is irrefutable. Your client might have had lots of reasons. He might have felt that house of cards was about to collapse, and that he would try to save himself some grief by owning up. Of course, he didn't own up to everything. He owned up for a little bit. Sounds highly fact intensive to me.
How is that argument different from the bank robber who goes to the bank the next day and returns the money? Same thing, isn't it?
It is, but it in this situation, when you let's say, yeah, you have a revelation, you change your mind, you want to come clean.
As Judge Kaczynski says, the fact finder could take it into account, but there's nothing that compels the conclusion that, there was no fraud to begin with, is there?
Well, yeah, but how can you have established by clear and convincing evidence a specific intent to evade a tax when you have the undisputed evidence that happened in this case?
Well, I thought part of it, though, didn't part of this relate to their estimated tax? Or no? On $135,000?
No. It did not have to do with the estimated tax.
There was no finding that there was a misestimation, which they attributed to Llewellyn?
Right, because of the omission, yes. But when the $135,000 was included in the amended return, all of the appropriate tax, penalty, and interest that accrued for that 3 or 4 week period was satisfied.
Thank you. Case is argued. We'll stand submitted.